I'm Mike Dowdy, and this is the School Leadership Show. Welcome to the only podcast dedicated to helping practicing and aspiring school leaders realize their potential, advance their careers, and achieve work-life balance. The School Leadership Show brings together the greatest minds from inside and outside of education to deliver you the insights and tools you need to succeed in school leadership. This is the show we wish we had 20 years ago. This show is about you. We're here to help you become the best school leader you can be while still having a life outside of work. In this episode, I interviewed Jen David Lang. Jen produces The Main Idea at themainidea.net, a monthly summary of current education books. Jen has over 30,000 subscribers and has an incredible perspective on where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed in education. We talk about the importance of building relationships, mistakes for administrators to avoid, tips for personal productivity, and much more. Enjoy this interview with Jen David Lang. And as always, send your comments, questions, and show ideas to mike@schoolleadershipshow.com. Consider rating the podcast in iTunes and leaving a comment. If you've made it this far listening to the podcast, you should have left a comment by now. And please pass the show along to your colleagues. Thanks. So I'm here with Jen David Lang. Jen, thanks for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
And you are the creator and the, I guess, purveyor of The Main Idea. How's that sound?
Well, I guess I should explain what The Main Idea is.
That would be great. If you could tell folks about The Main Idea, tell us a little bit about your background, and then we'll get right into it.
Okay, sure. Well, I guess I started teaching in the early 90s. I was a strange person. I taught both math and English. That always gets a second look. And I started an academic program for middle school kids right out of college as well. And I did that for a while until I got my principal's license at Bank Street. And after taking on a number of administrative roles, I decided to do some consulting. I helped people start new schools, train new teachers, did some coaching. And then I came up with the concept of The Main Idea. And basically, I connect school leaders from all over with some of the latest and best ideas in education by summarizing 8 to 10 compelling new books a year for them because they are too busy to do the reading themselves. And then in addition, I also write professional development suggestions that school leaders can use to train their own teachers or their own cabinet. And basically, I came up with this idea. I remember I had one consulting job with Norman Atkins. He's the person who started Uncommon Schools and the Relay Grad School of Education. And he was just at the point of starting his second school. And he said, Jen, I've got 30 books on my desk that I'm just not getting to. And I need to train a group of new teachers soon who are going to be at our new school. You know, can you help me out? And that's when I realized two things. First of all, even amazing school leaders just don't have the time to do the reading they wish they could do. And second of all, I realized that's how I read books. I read books, particularly about education and leadership, with a mind for how to train teachers. I remember when I was in high school, I was a very strong math student, and rather than spending time in class learning the material, I used to daydream about how I would teach the material. And I realized it's sort of the same thing now. I read an education book or a leadership book, and I think, as a principal, how would I introduce these ideas to my teachers? So that turned into The Main Idea, which is a subscription service, and principals subscribe to my service and get a book summary and a workshop idea about 9 months out of the year.
So how long have you been at it?
I started in 2007, so just over 8 years, I guess.
8 years. So you're closing in on 100 books, huh?
Yes, there should be about 70 up on my website once I get the last few up there.
Wow. How many subscribers do you have?
I have over 35,000.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So, and it ranges now. I'm not a principal anymore, but I subscribe. So it's probably beyond just principals.
Yes, I have a lot of district leaders, superintendents, directors of instruction, I have consultants, people at the college level, you know, who are teaching, I mean, at the graduate level, who are teaching aspiring leaders. So it's a wide range, but it's basically aimed for the school leader.
And how do you decide which books to review or summarize?
I get that question a lot. So I have my four criteria down. The first is there has to be some research beyond just an individual saying, this is what I did and I've learned. I'm hesitant to say research-based because I think that term is very abused and mm-hmm. thrown around, but I do look for some depth of research. Second of all, it has to be a topic of interest. I usually survey my subscribers every year or so to see what they're interested in, but just to see, you know, what's new, what's interesting. Third of all, and this is really important, is I look for books that you can use that have ideas that you can implement in your school or district tomorrow. There are a lot of great books out there about policy or criticizing certain approaches, but and I do some theoretical books, but I'm mostly interested in actionable books. So the fourth criteria is that it's got to be well-written, because what busy school leader is going to work a 14-hour day and then sit down and read a book that isn't engaging? And so I do hope that people read the books. So I look for well-written books as well.
So what percentage of books would you say you pick up and say, ooh, this one looks good, and then are like, no?
You know, it's hard. I do put down a lot of them because they don't meet the four criteria. And I also do look for books that work for a K-12 audience because I have school leaders who span, you know, that whole range. I look through dozens and dozens of books to choose the 8 to 10 that I summarize each year. Most of them I do put down. I'm looking for those outstanding books that will make a difference in the lives of busy school leaders. And then when I do summarize them, this is not a book review. This is not a paragraph in an educational journal. This is a full 8 to 10 page summary. So it really contains all of the major ideas in the book, along with enough examples so that you really understand what they're talking about. And then I try to include some of the tools that the authors are presenting so that you can use those tools, you know, charts or checklists, so you can use those in your own school.
Now, what kind of interaction do you have with the authors? I mean, do you have people beating down your door to say, Jen, review my book? Or are they like, oh God, Jen's reviewing my book? Or but Jen's summarizing my book. Well, how's that go?
Someone told me recently that a lot of education books only have an audience of a few thousand people. I don't know if that's true. So if you know, a book only has 3,000 to 5,000 people reading it, and I'm sending this out to 30,000 to 35,000 people, it definitely helps with popularizing that book. So yes, I have individual authors who write to me all the time and ask me to summarize their books, but I work directly with the publishers. I did not want to get sued when I set this up, so I introduced myself and I create just a simple agreement with the publisher that says, yes, you give me permission to write such an extensive summary of the book.
I wondered about that because I wondered how that fit with the publishers and if they had an issue with it, but probably not, because I imagine it increases sales, right?
Absolutely. I have some great relationships with publishers, some fabulous people who understand what the main idea is and who my audience is, and they send me free books and say, what do you think of this or this? And so I've had wonderful relationships with them, and I do this all, you know, legally with permission, so I don't step on anyone's toes. And I send them a draft of my work before I send it out, and some of them do send it to the authors, and some of them don't.
Oh, very cool. Now, you mentioned before that you survey your subscribers to find out what, you know, they might be interested in. What's your response rate like that, and what kinds of things do they tell you?
Well, principals are very busy, so I don't get a ton of people responding. I try to keep them short. But, you know, generally I find people are very happy with the service. It's very inexpensive, $40 or $50 a year for an individual, much, much less for groups. And so people are very happy with the service. And also, once they sign up, they get free access to all of the book summaries and workshops that are on my website. So people are very happy with it. I just try to get some suggestions for topics they're interested in or authors. And I do this, I guess, about once every year and a half.
Okay.
I'm probably due for it pretty soon. You're reminding me.
Oh, good. Can you hear the guy mowing the lawn outside? hear that?
It's good.
This is good. This is real podcasting right here.
In the trenches.
So we talked a little bit about how you decide what to pick. Now, so you've been doing this for, you're pushing a decade here of summarizing important works in, you know, education. What, you know, if you had to characterize where we've been, where we are, where we're headed, how would you, you know, based on what you've been reading and doing, you know, where are we in education right now?
Sure. Well, you know, I think over the last couple of decades, there have been a lot of top-down changes that everyone in education has obviously been impacted by, right? You've got your increased accountability in testing. You've got the Common Core State Standards. And you've got huge changes in teacher evaluations. I think in the past 5 years, over 36 states have changed their teacher evaluation processes alone. So there's obviously a lot of books about those topics. But where I think a lot of the profound changes come are really from the ground up. And I'm seeing that in the literature as well. First of all, teachers working and learning in teams for real results. I mean, when I started teaching, the only time we worked with other teachers was to plan field trips. But we certainly never spoke about our teaching, let alone spoke honestly about how our students are learning.
I used to call it, when I was teaching, I used to call it hide and teach.
Hide and teach. We used to call it kid talk sometimes, and you would talk for half an hour about the problematic kid, but you really weren't improving your teaching and improving the learning. So, but that's a great new theme that has come up and certainly has hit the literature. And certainly the use of formative assessment. I'm embarrassed to say, at the beginning of my career, if you had asked me, I probably couldn't have even defined formative assessment. And now just about every teacher knows what an exit ticket is and checks for understanding at some point. So formative assessment is huge. And in addition to teams and formative assessment, certainly the change from principal as manager to principal as instructional leader. And some of that certainly comes from, you know, changes in the teacher evaluation practices are making principals show up in classes more often, but it's also because of some research, like the well-known Wallace report about a decade ago showed that school leadership is second only to teaching in influencing student achievement. So now that we know how important the principal is, you know, what a waste to have the principal worry about, you know, refilling toilet paper and serving as a manager instead of an instructional leader. So those are some of the changes that I've seen in the world and also reflected in the literature.
Now, I got to ask this. What was the first book? I didn't go back on the website and look, but what was the first book that you summarized?
I think the first book, I had to change at the last minute. Something happened. But it's actually one of my favorites. It's Rick Dufour and colleagues, Learning by Doing. I don't have them in chronological order, but I think that is the first book. He writes about the power of teacher teams. He writes about PLCs and how they can address the gaps. But yep. I think that was the first
and
one.
That was and all, another was that when he was at Adlai Stevenson High School, all that
I don't know. He might have even been, I think he was done with that. He was already at the district level.
Okay.
But that was certainly an early one. And I also summarized Harry Wong's The First Days of School, which is really a book about classroom management, which many teachers find very useful. So for a principal to be able to have a summary of this very long book and be able to pass it along to struggling newer teachers was a fabulous resource. And I still get lots of people asking for my workshop ideas to use with Harry Wong's book.
That's a great book. That's the one I used to use as a required textbook when I taught classroom management at the graduate
okay.
level.
Yes. Yes. So those are a couple of the early ones.
So
and you asked about where we're going.
Yeah. Where do you think
well,
we're headed?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting and it's funny to see how this creeps into schools and literature at the same time. But I really see two big trends in the next 10 years for education. And the first one is personalization. Everything is personalized now. The apps on my phone don't look like the apps on your phone. The books that Amazon recommends to me are not the same books that Amazon recommends to you. And we are still living it as if our schools are still in the industrial age, where we have a certain number of hours and a certain number of credits before you graduate. And everyone who was born in 2007 is in the same grade. And, you know, this is really an old idea that education should be more personalized. It comes from, you know, certainly dates back to Ted Speiser in the 80s, who believed that we should graduate by demonstrating knowledge, not by number of hours you sit in the classroom. And those were great ideas, but I think now with technology and blended learning, more than ever, we're actually going to be able to personalize education and with the world as a more personalized place. So I think the first trend that exists now and just will become more and more prevalent is personalization. And then the second has to be 21st century skills. It's incredible the number of schools where students are still doing spelling tests every Friday. But I think that businesses are demanding it, and we are going to see more and more of the need for students who have actually been taught to collaborate, who know how to take initiative and are entrepreneurial, students who are curious, have an imagination, who are adaptable, who can communicate those kinds of 21st century skills. Tony Wagner writes a lot about this. But I think those two trends of personalization and 21st century skills are certainly in many of our schools, but they're going to be the norm within a decade or so.
Now, do you think, okay, this is going to be kind of an odd question. Well, maybe, maybe not. Do you think what's going on in the field is driving the literature, or the literature is driving the field, or is it some kind of balance there?
It's definitely a balance. You know, I mean, you've got the policy and the top down, and you have the practitioners, and, you know, we're all somewhere in the middle. Certainly some of the literature comes from people who were in the field 40 years ago, and some of the literature is from people who are there now, writing articles, writing books. So I don't think any change in any movement is just in one direction.
So you've interacted, you do some consulting work on the side, right?
I do, yeah.
So you've interacted with school leaders. Do you have any, you know, if you think about the constellation of folks that you've worked with, what would you say separates the really good and effective school leaders from the ones who are kind of meh? I won't say ineffective. I'll just kind of give it the meh.
So the first thing that always stands out are the leaders who understand, the importance of relationships in school. We are not creating widgets. And schools are complicated places, and, you know, the leaders who very clearly focus on communication skills, they prioritize people over things or projects, and they understand that you need to take time to develop trust, because trust is the glue that holds the school together. So it's you often can meet a leader, and in a very short time, you understand, you can see whether they prioritize relationships. Another area, outstanding leaders understand they can't do it by themselves, and they really understand the power of teams. And this certainly goes back to Rick Dufour. But as much as we would like, principals cannot observe teachers into better teaching one at a time in any sustained kind of way. The best principals get a school leadership team together to observe teachers. And even more importantly, they organize their teachers into teams to hold each other accountable, to help each other improve their craft. And so the most savvy school leaders know how not only to develop teams, but to set goals for teams and also to observe teams. Most principals go in and they observe individual teachers, but they often don't observe team time. So I think that the best principals prioritize relationships, develop and sustain teams. And then the third thing, and this is, should be very obvious, but as school leaders, we are running learning organizations. And yet we often don't see ourselves as learners as well. So principals who understand that they're going to improve themselves and their schools through learning cycles, assessing what's going on in their school, creating goals to create those gaps, and then implementing those new plans and doing it again. So school leaders who understand that they have to go through these learning cycles to to keep trying new things. They can't just buy what someone said. Oh, you need to flip your classrooms? Great, that'll solve our problem. No, we have to look at our own current reality, and we have to see what is the impact of what we're doing. One well-known author, John Hattie, he always says, know thy impact. That's the most important thing, to be able to look in the mirror and see what you're doing and make changes.
Wow, it's so much in there. I want to go back to kind of where you started with that whole idea of observing teachers working in teams. I'm a little embarrassed that I spent about 10 years as a principal, but I never really formalized that. I mean, you can learn a lot by watching how people interact with their colleagues.
Well, but not only that, and this is something that Michael Fullan writes about in his book, The Principal, it's just much more efficient. As a principal, how many of your 20, 30, 40, 50 teachers, how many of those classrooms can you get into a week? Even if you're doing mini observations, once a week? But if you meet with your seventh grade team and they're going over the latest student assessment, you can impact the entire team, which then impacts all of the teaching in all of their classrooms. So, some of the best leaders I know schedule in time to attend team meetings as frequently as they can and to observe them and, you know, do some mini PD with them at those meetings. But that's a bigger bang for your buck than individually going into every single classroom as much. Not that you should not go into individual classrooms, but this is a piece that's sometimes missing and what separates the good from the great.
Well, and then I think by extension, that's an opportunity for the supervisors of principals to watch how the principals engage in that kind of observation and feedback loop with the group of teachers.
Absolutely.
So I could see, I could see going in and observing a principal, observing a meeting, you know, kind of like how we, we'll do that from time to time where shadow principals or assistant principals as they're doing observations and kind of go through the process with them. But then to take that to the next step of, okay, so how do you facilitate a group of teachers or observe them and provide feedback on their practice in that setting? So
absolutely. And even if the superintendent can't be there, you could take a videotape of a principal working with the team and bring that back, and the principal can debrief that him or herself, and then together with other principals, with a superintendent. That's something that Paul Bamberg Santoyo writes about in his book, Leverage Leadership. And I haven't seen too many people write about that. I'm very impressed with the way he writes about managing and supervising school leadership teams, but also growing them, like you're talking about, developing them.
So we talked about the good things that, or the things that effective school leaders do. Any mistakes to avoid? Because this podcast is really aimed at folks who are either practicing or aspiring to be school administrators. So what are some things that you've, just watched people do and thought, oh, buddy, what are you thinking there?
You know, I think one of the biggest mistakes is it's sort of the opposite of the relationship. It's not listening and coming in with ambitious or mighty agendas without taking the time, especially if you're new in a school or new as a school leader, without taking time to know the stakeholders, the culture of the school, celebrate and respect what's there, listen to what's there. Thinking that communication is a soft leadership skill, I think that's a really big mistake, and it's actually one that's very hard to correct. It takes a long time to build trust, but you can actually destroy trust in less than a half an hour.
Well, and it's interesting because I agree with you completely. I've watched people who otherwise are very competent professionals go into a new environment with a deficit mindset, thinking, oh my God, this place is so broken. I have to save it. I have to fix it. And they're done. They don't go anywhere.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I just summarized a book that's not specifically about education. I also do leadership books. And this book is called Fear Your Strength. And so I think a lot of people become leaders because they have a great deal of energy and vision and they know how to make things happen. So all of us think, oh, well, these are great strengths. There's nothing wrong with this. But we don't realize that sometimes hidden within our strengths are our greatest weaknesses. So if you have the best ideas in the world, but you don't bring other people on board, or you don't listen to other people, you're not going to be able to implement your ideas. And so our downfall sometimes exists within our greatest strength. So I think that's a mistake to come in like a like a five-alarm fire.
Well, I was going to say, a wise person once told me that, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, then you're in the wrong room.
I love that. Yes. Yes.
Now, I asked you before about the first book that you summarized. Now, I'm going to ask you this question, and you can absolutely refuse to answer it. I'm fine with that. it's going to be like asking you, you know, which child is your favorite? I mean, do you have a favorite book over the ones that you've summarized to think, you know what, I nailed that one? Or that one, how about this one? We could put it this way, it'll save you from it. Is there one that has been, you know, that has received an overwhelming response from your subscribers?
Well, those are different questions, certainly, the response from the subscribers. But, I'll say that, you know, the three, I can't say that I did the best job on these particular books, but, you know, the books that have been the most eye-opening for me and that I think are the most important for education, I certainly think, and if people want to start their reading with these three, I would suggest Rick Stiggins' Classroom Assessment for Student Learning, that classroom assessment of student learning. He really does a wonderful job of turning assessment on its head and suggesting we've been using it wrong by using assessment just to measure student learning, that actually it's quite exciting. We can use assessment to motivate students and to help improve learning. And he does a fabulous job of describing that in Classroom Assessment for Student Learning. And then also I've mentioned him before, Rick Dufour, or any of his books about PLCs. And people often don't fully implement professional learning communities the way they were intended, but he did a fabulous job of getting teachers to focus on student results and for teachers to plan in a systematic way, what do we do when students don't learn? It's not if students don't learn.
It's
all of us
when.
Teachers know. It's when. You know, yep. What's our systematic approach when students don't learn?
And I agree. I feel bad about the whole PLC movement in that I think some folks who don't have a deep understanding of it think that anytime you get some people who are employed by a school district in a room talking at a meeting, it's a PLC.
Yeah, you know, and that sometimes happens because it's a top-down requirement. And
exactly.
People don't really take the time.
Like I anoint you as a PLC. Well, not really. There's a little more
right.
to it. Okay, so you mentioned Stiggins, Dufour.
I love Paul Bamberg Santoro's Leverage Leadership. He basically, you know, he's worked with thousands of leaders for more than a decade, and he came up with 7 areas of exceptional school leadership for dramatically improving student learning. And the book is packed. There's so much there. and, you know, he claims that with his approach, his teachers can make more than 20 years of improvement that a normal teacher would make in 1 year by improving the way we do observations and feedback. And then also his chapter on managing school leadership teams is just something we haven't spent enough time. So I think he really demonstrates the change that we've seen in recent years from supervisors asking, did we teach it, to did the students learn it?
Exactly.
So I think he's a great person for shifting the focus of our supervision to that more important question, did the students learn it? So those are three books that meant a lot to me, and I recommend for any school leader who's trying to kickstart his or her reading.
So Jen, we're closing in on our time here, and I want to be sensitive to your time. Now, I mentioned before, so this podcast is really about giving practical advice to school administrators, practicing and aspiring. And one of the things I like to ask folks, especially folks who I would identify as successful, which would be you, you know, what do you have any, you know, tips or tricks that you use in terms of productivity that, you know, that help you get your stuff done that might be helpful for others?
Well, I did notice in your podcast, you also don't just focus on education. You focus on other areas like health or productivity. And I think that's fabulous. I think that my most recent book is The Mindful School Leader. It's about incorporating mindfulness into your practice. I do think that we need to be balanced as people, and I don't always do such a good job with that, so that's why I'm kickstarting a four-week mindfulness challenge with my subscribers to try to get a few minutes of some relaxation, because sometimes when I don't exercise or take the time I need, I am not the most productive. So I salute you for that focus, and I certainly think that's a big part of being productive. And then I do think carving out times of your day for specific purposes, because as I'm sure you've heard, we often focus on what's urgent before what's important.
Yes.
So the emails coming in, the Twitter feed, you know, all of that is urgent, 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 but is that the most important thing I should be doing right now? So I think leaders who take, you know, from 5:30 to 7 a.m., I'm going to answer my emails, and then from 5:37 p.m., and that's it. I even know one principal who she sets an automatic response on her email from 7 a.m. to 5 or 6 p.m. that says, I'm sorry, I'm a principal, I'm in classes, I can't respond to your email until the evening. So I think carving out those times, I know for me, I need to do my biggest thinking and hardest working earlier in the day. And so I block out reading and writing times earlier in the day. And then when I need to answer emails, write an invoice, you know, just do smaller things, I save those blocks for later in the day when the brain and the body are a little bit more fatigued.
Absolutely. Perfect advice. I couldn't have said it better. Jen David Lang, thank you for taking time to talk with me today, and hopefully folks will sign up for The Main Idea. Where can they learn more about getting a subscription and about your work?
Sure. They can go to themainidea.net, and my email address is there if you want to email me, ask for any book suggestions, or if you have any other questions.
All right, Jen, thanks for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening to The School Leadership Show, a podcast for aspiring and practicing school leaders by school leaders. Send your comments, questions, and show ideas to mike@schoolleadershipshow.com. Consider rating the podcast in iTunes and leaving a comment. And please pass the show along to your colleagues.